I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, John Hartley. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it really is lovely to be meeting you and talking about a range of things. You're a Fremantle resident, which is a very good start, and we'll talk about Fremantle shortly, I think, about why people love it so.
Yeah.
But you're also an emeritus professor from Curtin University. Cultural science is one of your big areas, and people will be already saying to themselves, cultural what? We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
And one of the reasons for talking about that is I recently came across your recently published latest book, Make Believe, We and They on a Digital Planet, John Hartley. And your colleagues in the academic world say delightful things about it, a fascinating journey into the ever-expanding world of storytelling, story-making, and story listening as mechanisms for imagination and knowledge co-production, says Antonia Liguori, Professor of Participatory Storytelling and Public Policy at the Teesside University in the UK. Probably the UK is a good place to start this journey.
Okay.
John, because I think you started your journey in the UK.
Yes, I was born in London and grew up in various places around England, and then spent my academic career and my working career in Wales, in Cardiff.
Now, I'm interested in how that starts out. What was your first academic appointment, and did it have anything to do with what finished up being Make Believe, We and They on a Digital Planet?
Yeah, well, it was simply that I managed to get a scholarship to do a PhD after I finished an English Literature and Language degree. So it was really the PhD that got me started, and I was very lucky to have a mentor and supervisor who I really admired and who was a bit of a kind of enfant terrible. So he was a Shakespearean scholar, but he wasn't a kind of, acolyte at the altar of the immortal bard. He was actually interested in how Shakespeare had turned from being a popular dramatist into a kind of imperial icon. And he wanted to get to the bottom of what it is that was being done with Shakespeare rather than by Shakespeare.
Well, he obviously had an impression on you because the bard is one of the first people quoted in Make Believe.
Yes.
I've mentioned this world of sort of cultural science. You were something, I think, of a pioneer with colleagues in the field.
Yes, it's an attempt to suggest that the sciences, as we have probably got to know them too well, that is the old-fashioned empirical sciences based on observation, evidence and experiment, are not the only way to produce knowledge, even in the sciences, since relativism and quantum technologies and whatnot. We know there are lots of other ways of thinking about causation, sequence and complexity. And the biosciences are way ahead on taking account of things like evolution to explain what's going on right now in living life forms. But the humanities have been very slow to pick up on any of that for various reasons, some of them quite good. You know, they didn't want to follow social Darwinism into the idea that there are some people who are born this way and some people born that way. So what I'm interested in is how you can reconcile the contemporary sciences with an attempt to understand how humans make sense, how they relate to each other, and what happens next.
Well, culture, when you see the word culture, gets most people going. If you're at a party or a cocktail party or just having a drink with your mates down the pub with a few beers, and someone mentions the word culture, it can evoke, can't it? All sorts of responses. You're either too woke to be thinking about culture, or you're not woke enough because you're not thinking about it properly. But we live in Fremantle. is this some special place, John?
It definitely is. And that is my good fortune, because when I came to Australia, I was fortunate enough to go to Murdoch University as a lecturer in culture and communication. And there was a lot of very strange experimental early career thinkers and scholars, most of whom lived in Fremantle, associated with that period of Murdoch. And it was a wonderful time to start thinking about how knowledge is produced, who for, and what happens to it, out there in the wild, as it were. And so, yes, Fremantle had a lot to do with it. It was it's a place where people can congregate to think about these things and to share their ideas.
And I mean, why is it that place? I mean, for people teaching and researching at Murdoch, it's down the road more or less, not a long bus ride. You can even ride your bicycle there. But people have been congregating here in Fremantle culturally, or in a particular Frio cultural way, and probably different ways in different stages.
Sure.
But what is it about Fremantle today that attracts people like you?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's changed a lot over the years, obviously, as towns do. And, I mean, it was clearly a place where the early affluence of the gold rush made its mark, not only in all these grand buildings and banks, but also in the pubs and brothels and dance halls. And when I came here, the former German consulate was the Tarantella Club, and a wonderful music club it was too. And so it was a good place to come. And I mean, we went to the newly dubbed Sail and Anchor, which had previously been the Newport, I think, where there was a kind of Friday sundowner for Murdoch people who just congregated there. And so it's a place where you can come both to understand and participate in the development of a state, you know, from a very early experimental condition into something different, and to have some fun.
And in a sense, people feel accepted here if they feel they need to be accepted because they're not accepted somewhere else.
Yeah, it's very much like that. I mean, one of the things I like about Fremantle is that we have all social classes here, top to bottom, and we bump into each other quite frequently on the street, sometimes quite noisily. And I think that's a proper way of having a community, and so that's a good thing. I also think, you know, Fremantle has a commitment to the performing arts and to, you know, music in particular, but others as well, which resonated with me when I came here, because I was very much part of that period of British popular culture when things changed very much from the straight-laced 50s into the free and easy 60s, 70s and whatnot. So I think Fremantle's part of that too.
Well, it'll keep resonating. We are in the west end of Fremantle. We're looking out at the old pubs.
Yep.
Not sure about the brothels. You needed to know where they were, I think, and still do. How different, in a very broad cultural sense, was Western Australia, Australia, when you first came here and were exposed to it, given what you'd been in disciplinary terms, studying in the UK and teaching in a Northern Hemisphere academic environment?
I was quite shocked by how similar it was.
Oh.
And the similarity was not to, let's say, London or, you know, the familiar parts of Britain. I worked in Cardiff, and Cardiff was the capital of Wales. Wales was England's first colony, and I learnt a lot about how the English behave.
Just have to pause for a moment so all the Welsh people can stop cheering.
Well, good luck to them all. And so it was very much, I was surprised by how English and, in a certain sense, colonial the public culture was here when I got here. Much more than America. America's a deeply strange country, but Australia isn't.
Well, I think because it's a deeply strange country, my first admiration went to the US and North America when I was sort of a teenager, becoming a young adult here in Western Australia, and didn't want to have to have anything to do, as I saw it, with the class system that operated in the UK. But you have experience in North America, in the US.
Yep.
Why do you describe it the way you just did?
Partly because I think American public culture, but also American thought systems that kind of motivate how people relate to each other, are much more organized around American history than they are around European history. And the obvious difference there is that Europe is built on class systems and social hierarchy. America is built on slavery. And I think the legacy of that echoes to this day, and I don't think they've got over it. So the way they police each other, the way they're suspicious of each other, the way they worry about what's going to come through the front door if they're not careful, you know, all to do with slavery.
And shoot it if you're not sure.
Exactly.
Guns.
Yes.
The thing that struck me, particularly after I saw a fabulous American art exhibition of stuff from the mid-19th century on at the Met, I think, probably 15 years or so ago, was the extent to which self-determination, electing the local sheriff, electing the person to be the head of the school board, even in some states, electing judges to the state Supreme Court.
I mean, perish the thought.
Perish the thought, and they can sack you if they don't like you as well. But it has all of that to it, doesn't it? And it's quite exciting in some ways.
It's exciting in some ways, but it's much too individualist for the likes of me, because I came from a very deprived background. My father died when I was 6. I went to an orphanage. My mother was a pensioner. We had no money, blah, blah, blah. And so how the class system worked, but also how cooperative welfare worked, they were both very important things to me, you know, from both sides. And America doesn't have it. So I think the idea that we're all individually sovereign and individually responsible for everything, including everybody else's business, doesn't work.
I think one of the first things that I was exposed to about American popular culture in a thoughtful way was when I was getting towards the end of high school, and there must have been some new pedagogical device that our English teacher wanted to use. It had an impact on him, and as you gather, it had an impact on me. It was all about advertising. He wanted us to learn that when we were watching or reading advertising, it was designed to do certain things to us.
Yeah.
And we were, in a sense, having the whole psychology or the whole communication theory behind it all hitting us. So it's lasted with me. When I see an ad, I stop and watch it closely to work out what's it trying to do to me, so I don't let it do it to me.
You did media studies. How about that?
Is that what I did? Media studies.
It's very much, I mean, the famous pioneer of that was a guy called Vance Packard, who wrote a book called The Hidden Persuaders, I think, back in the 60s. And it was very much an I won't say unmasking, but it was an unravelling of what advertising was doing as a corporate and commercial institution in American life, for the users rather than for the benefit of the corporations themselves. It was the first time then, I think, that the idea that you could read popular culture in a way that was critical as well as consumerist was quite new, and they did do that.
So let's talk about cultural science. Let's try and see if we can weave from that PhD, that first academic appointment, journalism, communication, what was happening then? What were, if you like, some of the theories that abound? And, here we are today in a world so different. So people forget it was only really into the 90s that the internet arrived, and here you are writing a book about we and they. We'll explore the we and they meaning on a digital planet.
Yes.
My granddaughters don't know anything except a digital planet.
Exactly, yes, it has been quick. I think it's what's the thread that pulls through for me is actually journalism. I was a fan of journalism when I was a kid. I was too shy to be a journalist, but I really loved reading it. I was a big fan of Harold Evans, the great Sunday Times editor.
Thalidomide.
Thalidomide, and yeah. I met him, and he was as good as he practiced, as it were. So I was very much drawn towards journalism as a way of allowing ordinary people to participate in public culture in some way or another. So I understood that journalism was a narrative, it was an institution, it was often profit-making. You know, there's all those institutional sort of things to take account of. But actually, it was something that drew me in at that level of story and narrative and text. And I thought, well, journalism is doing as important a job as, you know, our great cultural icons like the novelists and Shakespeare are doing. Why don't people take it more seriously?
Well, I'm with them. I was one of the council assisting the WA Inc. Royal Commission in 1992, and I came then to fully appreciate and become a great supporter of what was called the Fourth Estate, the media.
Yep.
Because without them, who's brave enough just to go out and say what they think is happening? Yep.
Well, you can't go out and say what's happening without the media amplifying it, because if they don't, nobody will notice what you're saying. And so I think, you know, that role is not well understood, because people think that there's kind of truth and reality over here, and then there's media and illusion and, you know, whatever, story making over there. But actually they're part of the same setup.
They are part of the same. Without leading digital, but taking that into account, What is the make forward slash believe that appears on your latest book? And what is the we and the they on the planet, let alone the digital planet?
The reason for the title is that the computational turn, can I call it that? The conquering of how we interact with each other by computational digital means since, I don't know, the 2000s, is now planetary. We do live on a digital planet because supercomputers can monitor the planet in its entirety. We can know instantaneously what's going on across the world, and we are connected instantaneously to what's happening in different places. So we live in a digital planet in the sense that we know it through digital means. But most people are brought up in cultures that see outsiders with a degree of suspicion. One of the great things about culture is that it forms people into groups that can recognize and appreciate each other, a we group. And of course, that needs a boundary and an outside, and the outsiders are the they group. So we and they is a kind of natural production of cultural practices and language and story. It's hard to get anywhere without them. However, if we're having an effect as a species, humanity as a whole, on the planet as a whole, and we know it because we have the computational means to find out, then how can we ever act together to do something about that? So my motivation is not really to understand culture, it's to see whether culture can be self-regulated enough to take the voice of the planet into account, as well as the voice of all the partisan groups that contend with each other on it.
I love the way you've expressed that orally just now, because I read that in the book as well, and I've been trying to get my head around the concept. It, as I've read the book on the topic, it's not possible for us as a species to achieve that unified single global action. Is that the way?
It's certainly my impression that we haven't managed it yet. And the only time when you can see in stories how the human species as a whole can act is when it's threatened by aliens. So sci-fi is quite good at thinking about humans as a whole.
And we're under attack, they're coming now. Yeah,
exactly. So
so the Russians, the Americans, Rockingham,
yes,
and submarine base.
Well, we'll come to that.
We'll come to that.
The trouble is that we always project who we are into the humanity as a whole that's going to face down the aliens. So if we're Chinese, then they're Chinese heroes. If we're American, they're American, and so on around the world. So I don't think humans have done a very good job of thinking planetarily.
Well, I'm sure there's been more than one PhD written
if I may say so.
Yes.
The only kind of institutional language that does try that and has been trying that for a couple of hundred years is, of course, science.
Fact-based, evidence-based,
yeah.
Science.
And global, you know. It's, I mean, one of the great heroes of science is Alexander Humboldt, who realised that the mountainous plants that he was seeing in South America resembled the mountainous plants he saw in Germany, and that they varied according to altitude in both places. So he was able to understand that nature was global. And this was back in the, 18-somethings, I don't know when, 40s perhaps. So the idea that that life itself forms a unit around the planet is not new to science, but was quite slowly accepted by science over a period. And I just think culture needs to catch up.
I was going to say one of the we's and they's that many of us were brought up with, I certainly was in Australia, with the cowboy movies.
Yeah.
You knew who the goodies
GTV.
And the baddies were. The goodies were usually the same colour as I was,
yes.
White, but the Indians, who were called Red Indians, and yeah. Native Americans today, they were always having to be chased off and usually shot dead in the way. But that's all this storytelling, all this myth-making, and the quote that I gave you from someone whose job it is to think academically about storytelling and, I guess, myth-making. And your book, Make Believe, We and They on a Digital Planet, seems to have a lot of that in it. You're bringing to our attention who in perhaps the media, who in communications, who in the media is trying to project what sort of story with a conscious or an unconscious bias in it all.
I do think that, I mean, that's really the kind of urgency of the book, which is simply to say that stories have been associated with fiction and culture and make-believe, in the childish sense of that word, for a very long time, whereas facts and reality and, you know, serious stuff is done over in the sciences or in politics or in economics or what you will. But actually, all of those things are motivated as much by storytelling as they are by evidence and observation and methodological calculations. So storytelling is the means by which we communicate what we think about the world to each other, whether it's science or politics or economics. And this book is trying to say is that storytelling itself has been weaponized by the great powers in order to pursue what they see as winning. And there's a lot of evidence for that in the book, because it comes out of various American think tanks that have caused the American Defense Forces to pivot from straightforward, you know, we've got the biggest army in the world, so shut up, to we have to get out there into the non-state agencies and into the media and into culture and tell stories that win people's hearts.
Well,
and of course, if I may just say, they've been doing that since the 1920s in movies. The amount of the Department of Defense money that goes into Hollywood would surprise most people.
Making me wonder where the Charlie Chaplin's funding came from. Another topic.
But certainly Tom Cruise's.
Certainly Tom Cruise's. And yes, it's a form of product placement, I suppose. Well, let's turn to a more precise part of that very defence topic. You have a chapter in here about submarines.
And another one about aircraft carriers.
And another one about aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers, I saw a photograph just the other day of a new Chinese one. It must be about the size of one of those islands in the South China Sea. It's absolutely huge. Chapter 8 in your book,
yes.
Submarines at the End of the World, Great Game or Make-Believe.
Yep.
Now, just remind people who are listening, because I've been catching up, on the concept of the Great Game, capital G, capital G, and how this, why this chapter is in your book.
Well, it follows on from the one about aircraft carriers, where
yes.
Which used to be quite frequent visitors to Fremantle, and that's where I first encountered the Carl Vinson. But it came as a surprise to me to discover that the Australians had got rid of their last aircraft carrier, the Melbourne, by giving it or selling it to the Chinese for scrap, upon the wreck of which the Chinese reversed formed their knowledge about how to make an aircraft carrier, one of which is now patrolling the seas just outside. Yes. So that was that. And then I wanted to talk about how the global strategic enmity between the old empires of the 19th century has spilt over into the current period, even though nobody talks about empires anymore. And the Great Game was a term given to the contention between Britain and Russia in the 19th century, when both of them, Britain was a big maritime empire and Russia was extending from, you know, the original Muscovy area through Siberia and down into towards South Asia. And so the Brits were terrified that they would be interested in India. And so the Great Game was the kind of contention, diplomatic, military, and in other ways, for supremacy in particularly in Central Asia, Afghanistan, and the very wild areas around the Gobi Desert and all sorts of places that most people never think about and have no reason to. But actually that's where the kind of battle lines between these two old empires were drawn. And my view is that the Great Game continues, that the two empires are still at each other's throats, except that it's the American Empire and the Chinese Empire that are now the contending partners.
The Brits and the Russians, Mr. Putin, President Putin at least, would be a little annoyed with you to hear that, because they think they're very much involved in the Great Game still, don't they?
They do, and they you may have seen in the book they have a television program called The Great Game, which is about strategics. So yes, it does continue, and Britain still thinks it's a player, which is, you know, after Brexit is a worry to think about. But I mean, there's no doubt about where strategic power has gone. You only have to look at the aircraft carriers and the submarines.
Well, Fremantle Shipping News and its editor try to be, per force of just innateness or something, interested in most things that are happening, particularly around Fremantle.
Yeah.
And of course, the nuclear-powered US submarines now turn up. There's one down here being maintained right as we talk.
Yeah.
First time outside Pearl Harbor, it's been maintained somewhere else.
Yeah.
So we suddenly become part of what appears to be, feels like a global sort of military defence exercise. It's hard not to think that way.
There's no other explanation for it. And also, it's nothing new. Fremantle was the biggest submarine port in the world in the Second World War after Pearl Harbor, and not just for British submarines, but also Dutch ones from the Dutch East Indies of those days.
And the Americans.
And of course the Americans, absolutely. So we've been here before, been practicing. And I think the explanation for why it's happening really doesn't have much to do with Australia. It has entirely to do with the created narrative, a strategic enmity between America and China, which is a contest for the kind of political and economic supremacy and the kind of police of the world position that Australia would never want to aspire to. It's got nothing to do with us.
Well, I receive, Fremantle Shipping News receives the many communications from all sorts of organisations, including Australian Defence. So I'll get a media release two or three a day about what's happening here, there, in the Pacific, all sorts of goodwill things.
Yes.
It's interesting that these organisations do have a communications base.
That's right.
It's very helpful. I mean, I can get in touch with someone like me who's a journalist and understand what I want, and those that I'll be ringing them. And they're a good intermediary, really, between top brass who don't want to talk to anybody and the public. I suppose they've got a role to play, but is it more insidious than that?
Of course they've got a role to play, and I think that, you know, an agency these days that doesn't have some kind of public affairs department is kidding itself, so I get that. But it's the way they do it. And again, there's a quote in there about a military exercise up in Darwin, which is really cast in the apocalypse now sort of language rather than in the language of defence or Australia's interests. I noticed you had a story from the Navy about the development of the submarine repair process in Fremantle, and they're talking about us having sovereign something or other.
Yes.
I can't remember what it was, but
it caught my eye too, and I thought, oh well, I'll put it in.
Yes.
That's the way they're thinking.
That is the way they're thinking. So you get it, you can glean ideas about what they're really talking about, but the idea of sovereign capability in a multi lateral world is bizarre in the first place, but in the second place it can't be sovereign because they're all American submarines, you know.
So it's not just the Bard who started playing with words and seemed to use them so well and created pictures and images and got emotional forces running. We've really seen that today. It's not so far removed from my English teacher getting me to interrogate the advertisements I was seeing.
Your English teacher getting you to interrogate advertisements, but your English teacher also trying to persuade you against all your better judgment to read Richard III. Now, Richard III has a terrible reputation across the world, English-speaking and otherwise.
Yes,
and it's all Shakespeare's fault.
All Shakespeare's fault.
So he had a bad publicity. And you could say that Shakespeare was a kind of publicist for the Tudor monarchy, whom he served and who he didn't want to cut his head off. And he wrote plays according to their perspective on strategic matters and not on the others. So what was Richard III? Well, funnily enough, he was the last king before the Tudors killed him and took over the monarchy.
So when you teach and write about the subjects that you teach and write about and have taught and have written about, what messages are you wanting to give your students, whether they're straight out of school studying their first degrees or their postgraduate, are you wanting them to become like a Harold Evans, really, a protector of something we call the public interest?
Well, in that part of Harold Evans, yes, but I don't have a great deal of faith in the kind of truth warrior model of the kind of journalist that, you know, was popular in those days. I think what I do try and do is to get people to become critically literate for themselves rather than simply to, you know, assume that what's being said to them can be taken at face value. So that's one thing, critical literacy.
Why use that word sovereign?
Exactly, exactly. So simple stuff like that. And, I mean, popular culture is a terrific place to do that because some of it's very appealing and wonderful. I mean, popular culture is full of absolute genius, but at the same time, it's also pushing an agenda, and it may be an agenda you don't necessarily want to participate in. So how do you work that out? That's, you know, kind of unraveling what's going on in the stories and the music and the performances and the visual arts. Right across the board is what we want our students to be aware of. But in later years, I think it has become quite clear that the state, and not just in Western countries, but particularly in non-Western countries, the state, commercial corporations, and various kinds of institutional players, think tanks, for example, are, as it were, colonizing and capturing storytelling for purposes, you know, that are quite at odds with the communities that they apparently serve. And I think that the relationship between popular culture as a place where you have fun and you're not having to think about how terrible the world is, and how terrible the world is, these things have become horribly entangled. And, you know, I think people need to have a way of coming to terms with that, because community life, as understood in the old ideas of popular culture, when you lived cheek by jowl with people and, you learnt who you were through those community relationships, doesn't exist anymore. And what does exist is consumerism and shopping malls and digital media and social media. And so how people connect with each other and learn about each other and tolerate each other is a very open question right now.
Well, it brings one very much back to your book, The Digital Planet. When I was a kid, just going back to that, didn't really much matter whether you're in isolated Western Australia or the other side of the country in Sydney or in New York or Cleveland or London. There'd be one newspaper, there might have been an afternoon newspaper. Yeah. Television slowly came in, and we watched during the queue 6 o'clock rock, I think, on a Saturday night, and that helped to form Australian younger people's popular culture. But then it all kaboom.
Yeah.
It got hit. Yeah. These organisations, these media organisations, survived on being a monopolistic advertiser, and you had to pay them the money that they asked for. Yeah. Suddenly they lose their advertising. An organisation like The Guardian eventually goes digital, totally, which what the Shipping News was modelled on.
That's
that,
right.
That particular model, because why would you in this world go hard copy? There are reasons, but we didn't. And then suddenly you get your news on Facebook.
Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg, the movie, the social network, was something like 2007. It's hardly any time ago.
Yeah.
So how is culture affected? Presumably it's ruptured compared to what it was.
Yeah. Things have changed, there's no doubt about it. And I think, you know, corporations, especially the big tech platforms, are now more powerful than most countries, and they know it. And they've got agendas. They want to do things their way, as we're now learning from Mr. Musk. And I don't think that was quite so obvious, although it may have still been true. I mean, Rupert Murdoch came to Britain in the 1960s and took over The Sun, and things have, you know, Harold Evans ended up working for him, or not working for him. So things were changing back then, but we didn't see the implications of it quite so clearly as are evident now.
The Murdoch presence, though, UK, Tony Blair, here, Hawke and Keating, Kurt Murdoch would run his sort of seminars in various fancy locations. All these leading politicians would flock to him.
Yes, that's right.
And fascinating. And that Trump and his relationship with Murdoch and Fox, it's all still there. I mean, yeah. It looks very old world in many ways.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying earlier about how state and corporate interests come together, and they do work hand in glove with each other. I mean, Murdoch had a strong role, shall we say, in political decision making in Britain when he didn't like someone. So the Labour Party under Neil Kinnock didn't have a hope in hell, but under Blair, who found some way of accommodating with him, they did. So, you know, there's no doubt that that kind of stuff goes on, and it is for the commercial interest of the person running the company, not for the public interest, whatever that is, of the country who's, you know, buying the stories. So I think the what's different now, especially with social media, is that people have begun to realise that they do have the means of production in their hands, and they can do things for themselves. And I think in smaller groups and, as it were, alternative media, and that includes what we call hyperlocal media, the small local,
like Fremantle Shipping News,
news organisations like FSN, who does get a mention in my book, and you know, those kinds of enterprises are very often, they're not paid, they're not profit making, they're not professional in any sense, which makes them very weak in terms of, you know, being able to carry themselves on, and yet it's a strength because it means people are doing it because they want to do it, as we are now, rather than because they're getting a dollar for it. So I think things are changing because social media allow them to.
Because it enables it. Everybody can do that, and it's a little bit like that 100 flowers bloom. Some of the hyperlocals and similar might flower and bloom, others might fall away. But yes, the community's there wanting to participate in the things the community wants to be heard on.
Yes.
Where they cease to fully trust that those traditional voices that have hung on somehow or another are doing that job.
Yeah.
Are you prepared to be sort of brave and say where you think this is going?
I think the end of things is more clearly delineated than the beginnings of new things. And so I do think the era of, for example, public service broadcasting and media is at an end. I think the ABC is kind of evidence of that, although I don't necessarily want to say anything bad about the ABC, but I wouldn't turn to the ABC to run a story like the one we're now discussing, or many of the things that happen in Fremantle. They just don't appear in there, and the ABC is supposed to be our local outfit. SBS is very good for multicultural, but it hasn't got enough kind of feet on the ground, as it were, over here. So if you're going to have a forum for people to just chew the cud on what's going on in their city, and even just to record some of its pleasures and pains, then the hyperlocal kind of voluntary or media, which is place-based, which is commitment-driven, and which is community-oriented, those are really important things, and people will respond to them. I certainly have. I think Fremantle Shipping News was a great... it was wonderful to see it happening because there wasn't anything like it, and now there is.
It really is an interesting exercise in, yes, the power of free speech, community, and trying to, I think it helps to create a community. Yeah. You're never quite sure what's happening.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, then, there's this broader community. You also, you almost popularise Greta Thunberg, who doesn't need any popularising, but in the book, you come back to her on a number of occasions and make me realise there's an additional depth to her outlook about how the way the world works that I hadn't fully appreciated.
Right. Well, she's a brave woman, and I mean, she's proving that now with her work on Palestine and the Freedom Flotilla trying to get food into Gaza. And she's, I mean, the thing about Greta Thunberg is that she was so easily dismissed and belittled and scorned when she was a 15-year-old girl, and at the same time also drawing 6 million people onto the streets of the world with her Fridays for Future school strike for climate back then. So she has both the kind of vulnerability of somebody who is of no account and the strength of somebody who can pull a crowd and make things, you know, kind of dance. She has both of those things, and she has them through social media. Greta couldn't exist without social media.
No.
It needs that amplification.
And in fact, she needs you might say, the traditional media as well. Yes. Lynch is on the flotilla, cameras flown over, and there they are.
But there are two ways of doing it. There's a very impressive Fridays for Future activist from Germany called Lisa Neubauer, who has really begun to kind of migrate towards mainstream politics in Germany, coming out of her youth activism. Whereas Greta doesn't do that. Greta is a world figure. She's interested in what's wrong with the world and with the planet, not in gaining power in a particular
jurisdiction. It's not a conduit to power. It's a conduit to the sort of activating the world's conscience, in a sense.
I think so. And also feeling that you have to stand up for what you believe in, and she's doing it. So I do think, I very much admire her. She's autistic, I'm autistic, I think, you know, all power to us. And I think the rubbish that comes through from the haters is proof that, you know, she's onto something, but at the same time she needs an amazing level of bravery to just stare it down. And much is made of, you know, how she behaves rather than what she believes.
What she's saying.
Yes. So you know, it's a hard gig.
It's a very hard gig, and I wonder how people survive it. She's obviously got wonderfully supportive parents and probably a micro community around her.
She does, yeah.
It takes you back, though, to where we were starting the conversation today, and that is, are humans in not just an idealistic, dreamt of way, capable of acting as one?
Mm.
We're seeing things like climate change, if not going down the gurgler, being put over to the back of the stove on a cool plate at the moment, or a hot plate, I'm not sure which.
Well, indeed, yes. I mean, I think that's a big question, and it's one we ought to kind of worry and tug at like a terrier a bit more than we do. So on the one hand, I think humans are, they're kidding themselves. There's an element of make-believe about their own supremacy in the world. They think they can rule the world, have dominion over nature, and it's all down to, you know, the prowess of the individual. But actually, that's never been true. Humans have always relied on machines, on external assistance of one kind or another. For example, institutions or monarchies, whatever, to do what they do. And so the idea that action is an individual choice, as opposed to something that groups do as a group, so it's a group that acts, not just an individual, or it's a mechanized system that acts rather than just an individual, is a lesson we found very hard to learn. And we generally learn it through fear rather than trying to make something happen about it. So, you know, we're very worried about zombies, and we're very worried about various alien species that don't exist who might take an interest in us. Why would they? And yet we still think that we are sovereign and entitled to rule the world. Well, we need to unlearn all that.
Should tell our listeners that aliens and zombies make it to this book as well.
They do, yes.
So, again, a little more metaphorically, but
yeah,
not entirely so, when you got to the end of writing this book, how did you conclude? What did you want to leave us all with? Of course, this will help to draw to an end this very interesting podcast.
Okay. Well, I felt very depressed, well, on the one hand, but I'm not supposed to admit that. And on the other hand, what I really feel is that people need to work locally in the environment that they find themselves in. And they need to kind of understand that that involves taking more seriously things that they have previously been taught to treat rather scornfully. And the best example of it in the book is journalism itself, which has this wonderful kind of, divide and rule difference between the truth warriors, male, out there in the world, on the one hand, and on the other hand, lifestyle journalism, which is okay for, you know, domesticity and personal formation, but not really very interesting as news. And journalism has lived with that for a very long time. My view is that that's where some healing can go on, and that if you take lifestyle more seriously and say people who can make their own lifestyles using media, using machinery, technologies, and also their relationships with others in a complicated world, if you take that more seriously, then what can you achieve inside that space? Not where you're trying to, you know, represent an empire, but where you're trying to live communally together.
John Hartley, it's been lovely talking to you, and thank you for sharing all those insights. And there'll be people who want to get your book and start reading it. How do they do that?
The easiest way is online, of course. It's published by Bloomsbury, and you can get it from their website.
We'll provide the link. Thanks for joining me today, John.
Thank you very much, Michael.